returning to the book of Acts after a little break through the holidays and a little break with the prophecy update. And by the way, if you missed any of those prophecy updates, any of those chapters, I just encourage you to talk to Paul about getting the CDs for that and getting yourself familiar with some of the end times things and some of the great scriptures in the Bible relating to the end times events. But this morning, we're back in the book of Acts. We're in chapter 25. And the title of the message this morning, I think a good one to start off a year is, how does God measure success? How does God measure success? It's important for us to understand this morning. As we go through life, it's important to see things in light of the way God sees things. To see what being a successful Christian really is. A lot of times we can take scriptures in the Bible and apply them incorrectly and think that success has something to do with what we achieve in a worldly way or what we gain in a worldly way. Sort of like in Joshua chapter 1, verse 8, it talks about how if we're meditating on the law or the word, and if we're in God's word, that our way will be prosperous and successful. And it would be easy for us to say, well, if I open my Bible and read it every day, then God will bless me financially, and God will bless me in ways where I'll have success at work and where I'll have more control and more power and all those sort of things. And it's important for us this morning to see what God sees as successful. Someone once said, success is being able to hire somebody to mow the lawn while you play golf for exercise. And I think sometimes that's how we can measure success. But maybe the most successful Christian since Jesus was the Apostle Paul. A lot of times we can look at his life and admire him from afar in the scriptures, but yet not apply the same grid that he had for success. And we can look at Paul in it and say, oh, it's just, he's so dedicated and so sold out and so this and that. And yet admire him in such a way where we don't see that being the same for our lives. And so it's important that we see things correctly and we see what God sees as the correct grid or model for success. Paul's life was very different than the world's model for success. I think the quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer says it best. He says, the figure of the crucified invalidates all thought which takes success for its standard. I'll read that again. The figure of the crucified invalidates all thought which takes success for its standard. Interesting, huh? When you look at the cross and what it represents and Jesus there, that model of success invalidates all other worldly models for success. I want to look at that this morning. And the book of Acts, then, we're picking up this thing that Paul has been experiencing all the way back in chapter 21, this experience of Paul in Jerusalem. It's been a wild ride for Paul in Jerusalem. But back in Acts, when Paul got saved, back in Acts 9:15, when Paul got saved, the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles. This is Paul's ministry. Before kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. So this was given to Paul, this track or plan or calling in his life, that his life would be a life that would be before kings, would be before great men of this world. And as Paul would hear those words, I wonder if he realized how that was going to happen. Maybe a lot different than he would think. And sometimes for us, God will have a calling for us, and we see visions of greatness, visions of successful ministry, or visions of things that the Bible talks about, and yet maybe we don't like how we're going to get there. Maybe we don't like the circumstances that will be involved in giving us the opportunity to share our faith with somebody else. See, I personally don't think Paul realized the way he would be before kings and rulers and great men of this world would be that he would be put in prison and locked up. He might have gotten excited that he would be used in such a great way, but the way that that happened would be such a difficult way, a difficult road that he were to travel. You recall back in Acts 21 when he was in Tyre, it says in verse 4, "And finding the disciples, we stayed there 7 days, and they told Paul through the Spirit not to go up to Jerusalem." They didn't want him to go there. They knew that would be a dangerous place for Paul. Later in the same chapter, in verse 12, when Paul was in Caesarea, it says, "Now when they heard these things," a different group of people, "both we and those from the place pleaded with him not to go up to Jerusalem. And Paul answered, and he said, 'What do you mean by weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus.'" And so Paul did arrive in Jerusalem. He did know what awaited him. And as Paul arrived there, you recall the story that he was received gladly by the Christians there in Jerusalem. And Paul would explain what had happened to him and the success in his ministry as he would travel along. And they were grateful for that. But at the same time, there were a group of Jews who were spreading rumors about Paul. And they were saying that Paul was against Moses, he was against the temple, he was against Judaism, which wasn't true. And so they began to carry out a plan to take care of Paul, to hurt him. And so these rumors spread, and Paul was taken captive by them. He was being beat by those Jews in Jerusalem. And the Roman soldiers saw what was going on, and the commander knew that this would be a problem, that in his area that he was the commander, that there would be a revolt or an uprising. He couldn't have that on his watch. And so what he did was he went down to the area where Paul was being beaten by a Jewish mob, and he snatched Paul away, sort of rescuing Paul. And he asked the crowd, "What did he do? What's going on? Why is there such a problem with this man?" And all the people answered different things. They didn't have a clear-cut reason why they were doing what they were doing to Paul. And so the Roman took Paul away, and he was going to put him in the barracks. He handcuffed him or bound him, and just as the prophecy stated. And as he was going, Paul said, "You know, can I just speak to these people? Can I say a word to these people?" He was granted the ability to speak to the crowd that was trying to kill him. And he began to testify of what God had done in his life, of Jesus Christ, of the miracle of salvation and of conversion. At the end of his testimony, they wanted to kill him again. And so the Roman soldiers took him away in the barracks. And as he was in the barracks, they began to examine him. That means they began to scourge him or whip him or flog him to get the truth out of him. And as they began to do that, they realized that Paul was a Roman citizen, and it was a big no-no to have capital or corporal punishment on a Roman citizen without a trial. And so they stopped. They held Paul there for a while. At the same time, there were a group of about 40 Jews who were conspiring to kill Paul. And so as they conspired to kill Paul, they were going to ambush him as he was to be moved from place to place. The word got out, and the Romans decided to move Paul then away from Jerusalem. And they did so in the middle of the night. They moved him down to Caesarea. And as they moved him down to Caesarea, he then would come in contact with the headquarters of Roman government at the time. He'd come in contact with Felix, who was the governor over the area at the time. And they would hold them there and hold them there until his accusers would come to Caesarea. And then they would have a court there in Caesarea. So all this time here, you have to see that Paul could have been, may have been thinking, I'm supposed to be out there preaching to people. I'm supposed to be out there ministering to people. I'm supposed to be out there planting churches. But here I am, I'm a prisoner. I'm held captive. And this plan that God has for me doesn't seem like it's working itself out. But as we see things unfolding, Paul is being able to preach the gospel to kings and to noble people, to high people, and the multitudes at the same time. As he was there in Herod's palace then, he was in this area called the Praetorium. And that's where they kind of kept him secure. And as the accusers came up from Jerusalem, see, Paul was sort of a difficult person to the Romans because the Jews wanted him dead, but yet there was no actual offense that they could accuse him of. And so the Romans could not kill him or do away with Paul because he was a Roman citizen and that would be a violation of their law. He was a big problem. And so the Jews came up from Jerusalem. They came with a special lawyer, and the lawyer, he sort of presented his case. At the end of his case, it was found that there was nothing to accuse Paul of. There was no grounds to carry on any further action. But because Felix, the governor, owed the Jews a favor, he just kept them locked up. That's where we come to this morning. We come to the place where it's been 2 years now where Paul's been locked up. And look in verse 27 of chapter 24. Verse 27 of chapter 24, it says, "But after 2 years, Porcius Festus," that's Governor Festus, "succeeded Felix, and Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound." That's where I want to begin this morning. If you're taking notes, we're talking about measuring success, how God measures success. The first thing I'd like to point out is, for the Christian, success oftentimes is measured by patience. Notice, Paul then was locked up for 2 years. Paul has not been able to travel freely and do the things that he previously had been able to do when he would travel from city to city, preach the gospel, plant churches, and then move on to do it again. And then he would go back and visit those churches, building them up, establishing them in doctrine, taking care of issues and getting them straightened out. That was Paul's ministry. Well, it seems as if for a time all that was on hold. But it wasn't. And see, some of the false means that we have today for measuring success could have been a big problem for Paul. If Paul would have measured success by how much he was doing, Paul would have been at this moment a big failure, wouldn't he? Sometimes we can do that. measure success by how much activity is going on, how many things are going forth from our lives. But that's not necessarily success. That was pointed out to us by Jesus himself when Mary and Martha were hosting a dinner for Jesus. And Martha was there busy in the kitchen just serving up and working up a great meal. Why, at the same time, when Jesus came in, Mary was just sitting at the feet of Jesus. Who's more successful there? Well, Jesus told us that Mary had chosen the better thing. And the better thing wasn't just doing more things. The better thing was sitting at the feet of Jesus. So it's important for us then to see, first of all, that a good measure for success for a Christian is being patient. The Old Testament gives us a great example of somebody not being patient. And the result of not being patient, and that was Abraham. Abraham had two sons, and we've talked about them before, Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael was the son that was a product of impatience, was a product of, I got to do things my own way in my own time because I don't like the way things are going now. And so now I need to exert my own thought process and my own agenda and my own plan so that God's results can happen. We need to be careful of that. And Ishmael was not recognized as even a son of Abraham because it was a product of impatience. It was a product of the flesh. Man doing his own thing independent of God. And did you know, for us, a lot of times this will be a big measuring stick of our success as a Christian. God will allow us to go through times where things are not happening the way we like them. Things are not happening the way we want them to. Things are not gratifying us on a fast enough level. Surely God will test us and allow us to be tested in these areas so we will see where we are at with the Lord. I wonder how many times the world looks at patience as a measure of success. I don't think much, because the world will tell us about the importance of things happening now, about the importance of not letting life pass you by and making things happen now, taking the bull by the horns now, making life happen now. And that's not how God measures success. God measures success often by our ability to be patient and wait on the Lord. This is what Paul had to do. The next thing is found in verse 1 of chapter 25. It says, now when Festus, this is a new guy now. Felix was the old governor. Festus, 2 years later, is the new governor. He was appointed governor about 60 AD. He only was in office for about 2 years. He was a better guy than Felix, generally a good guy. Felix was a bad guy. Now, when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days he went up from Caesarea. That was the headquarters of Roman government at the time, sort of like maybe Austin in our state or Sacramento in California. So he went from Caesarea, he went down to Jerusalem, verse 2. And then the high priest, the chief priests, or the chief men of the Jews, they informed him against Paul and they petitioned him. So this thing hasn't died after 2 years. Now this is the other side of the equation. This is the Jewish side, the Jewish people who wanted Paul dead. This is their chief priests, their leaders. This is the religious attack on Paul. It says, asking in verse 3, asking a favor against him, that he would summon him to Jerusalem while they lay in ambush along the road to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself was going there shortly. So Festus is in Jerusalem. One of the first things he wanted to do was to get on the good side of the Jews. He didn't want a revolt. He didn't want any problems from the Jews. He just wanted things to be quiet. So he goes down to Jerusalem. First thing he does in office, he goes down there and he speaks to them and they bring up Paul again. It's been 2 years. This Paul thing has been festering, has been simmering, has been burning, this hatred and anger to the point where they haven't let it go. And so they ask Festus, hey, can you do us a favor? Can you move Paul? And while you're moving him from Caesarea to Jerusalem, we'll ambush him, we'll kill him, and we'll be done with Paul. Everything will be fine. Festus says, no, he's in Caesarea right now. It'd be better. I'm going to go back to Caesarea. It'd be better if you guys came up there. And then we can discuss this issue. And so in verse 5 it says, therefore he said, let those who have authority among you go down with me. The high rulers, the lawyers, the chief priests, you guys come down and accuse this man to see if there's any fault in him. And when he had remained among them more than 10 days, then he went down to Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. So 2 years later now, here Paul's being brought out of his confinement. And as he's brought out of his confinement, he's got a new governor. He's got new people coming. Maybe some of the old people, but some new people, religious people coming to accuse him as well. He's got to go through this whole thing again. Even though the prior governor, Felix, said, I don't know, I don't find any problem, no fault in this guy, but I'll hold him for you. 2 years later, Paul comes out. The governor is sitting in judgment seat. Paul probably is looking disheveled. Paul was not a very attractive looking person. He was very short. He didn't see well. He was balding. He was a person that was described probably in our day and age as sort of nerdy. And here he is, just this guy. He's all bound up and chained up, and he comes in and you have all these very dignified people there sitting in judgment of Paul. See the contrast here. It's amazing to me to see the contrast of what the world sees as successful. The rulers, the men sitting in judgment of Paul, the high and mighty religious people, and Paul just coming out probably all chained and disheveled for doing nothing absolutely wrong. Who's more successful in that case? Well, the next thing, if you're taking notes, not only is success measured by patience, success is also measured by a good conscience. I wonder how many times the world will look at how great it is to have a good conscience. Paul was real big on that thing. And no doubt this was one of the issues that caused him to have so much peace when he would come up against his accusers. Because continually they would find no fault in him. There's something to be said, and a lot that God says about having a good conscience. To God, this is success. The world will often exchange a good conscience for worldly success. Oftentimes people will step over people, backstab people, lie against people so they can get ahead. And you know, most of the time it really works. In a corporate setting, in a competitive setting, in a political setting, that can work. But biblically speaking, a good conscience, being able to sleep at night, being able to know that if somebody were to point the finger at you, there would be nothing that would ever stick. And knowing that before God, your conscience is pure and clean no matter what anybody may say to you. That's what's given to the Christian as God washes away the sins and gives us peace with God. In Acts 23, it says, Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. No doubt this was something that Paul was proud of. This was something that Paul can say, hey, no matter what you say against me, I stand before God clean, pure. There's a lot to be said about that, isn't there? And Paul in Acts 24, he said, This being so, I myself strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. So this is how Paul saw success. He saw it as patiently enduring. He saw success as having a good conscience before God and men. He also wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 12, For our boasting is this, the testimony of our conscience that we conducted ourselves in the world in simplicity and godly sincerity, and not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God and more abundantly towards you. Do you notice Paul is saying something there that his conscience was not only clear before God, it was clear with other people. That was important to him. That he wouldn't do wrong to people. He wouldn't think it's okay just because somebody wasn't presently with him to talk bad about them. Because he saw that as something that would injure his conscience. And he saw that as something that God was concerned about, even though maybe the person would never know about that. And see, so often we can do these outward things that make us look good to other people. But what Paul was going after was not those things that would make us look good to other people. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in the condition that he was in. But what he was concerned about is that his conscience before God and towards men would be clean. That nobody would ever be able to say about him, Hey, did you know Paul said this about you when you weren't around? Did you know that Paul sort of took advantage of you here or there? People wouldn't be able to say that about Paul. And the way he would see success is to know that he did whatever it took and whatever he could so that he could never be accused of that. And that's why often he would work to earn money so that people couldn't say that he was trying to take advantage of them and that he was doing what he was doing so that he could become rich off of other people. And so he would write that he had every right that he should make his earning from preaching the gospel. But just so that these areas that were hypersensitive and very touchy because of these false prophets that would swing through the area, he said, I'd rather work just so I know my conscience is clean before you and that to know before God that I haven't offended anybody. But is that how we look at success today? Do we look at success inwardly as my conscience is pure and clean because I stand before God in such a way where I know I've done no wrong to people and no wrong to Him? The third thing is found in verse 7. Now when Paul had come out to be judged there, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended or anything at all. But Festus, the governor, wanting to do the Jews a favor. There it is again. You see that false motivation here, which people would see him as being so successful. But in God's eyes, that's not success, because he made his decisions not on what was right, but on trying to butter both sides of his bread, if you will. Trying to make everybody like him, trying to be political, trying to work both sides instead of just doing the right thing. It says he answered Paul and he said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Which there was no reason for Paul to do that, because when he was in Jerusalem, they didn't find anything. So they sent him to Caesarea. Now in Caesarea, he's saying, "Are you willing to go back to Jerusalem to be judged by the religious people?" So Paul said in verse 10, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged." This is where I should be judged. "They haven't found any religious problems with me." He said, "To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything deserving death, I don't object to dying. But if there's nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, not one can deliver me to them. Then I appeal to Caesar." Ooh, that was a big thing there. That's like appealing to the president. That's like saying, "Hey, this is the highest court of the land is what I'm appealing to, because I'm still here and nobody's been able to find any fault. Why should I go back to Jerusalem?" That's like double jeopardy for you law people. It's like being tried of the same thing twice. He said, that doesn't make sense. "So I appeal to Caesar." In verse 12, "Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, he answered, 'You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go.'" That was Caesar Nero at the time. Now, the third thing here then I'd like to point out, if we're going to measure success correctly, is measuring success by our surrender. This is a good one. God measures our success by our surrender to Him. You see what Paul said there? He said, "Hey, I've already been tried down there. If you want to send me back there, that's up to you." Because he saw and realized his whole life had been given to God. And so the working out of his life was in God's hands. It's only the person who has surrendered their life to God that can then allow the working out of the details of their life to be in God's hands. You see, when we surrender our life to God, that's not our responsibility anymore. Did you know that? When we surrender our life to God, then the details of our life and the working out of our life then is in the hands of God. It's His responsibility now. That's a wonderful place for our lives to be, in the hands of God, wouldn't you say? Because as we place our lives in the hands of God through absolute surrender, now it's God's responsibility then to take care of our lives. It's God's responsibility to make sure that the plan that He has for our life gets accomplished and gets fulfilled. You see, God had promised Paul that he would end up getting to Rome. God had a plan for Paul's life, and because of Paul's absolute surrender to that plan, then Paul wasn't so concerned about where he was at that point. You see how that works? So we don't have to freak out and say, "God, your plan is not working, and I'm in a place where I'm not being able to be used by you fully, and I'm not being able to minister, or I'm not being able to use my gifts like I should." We don't have to worry about all those things, because it's God's responsibility to open those doors up for us, to create opportunities for us. That is not our responsibility anymore. We don't have to sit and create our own opportunities, because Paul had said that he had prayed for open doors to happen. And God would have to open those doors. And so you see how this all works together. As Paul saw success as being patient, he saw success in his responsibility of honoring God. And he saw as successful his surrender to God, whatever condition or circumstance he may be in at that particular moment. He saw that as, this is where God has me. That's a surrendered life. And I believe this is one of the most important things that the church needs today, that we need in our own lives, is an absolute surrender to God in our life. Every aspect of that in our life. Paul understood that, and Paul was successful at that because he understood the grid of success was a lot different than the world's grid of success. In Acts chapter 20, verse 21 and 22, he says, "And see now, I go bound in the Spirit to Jerusalem, not knowing the things that will happen to me there, except that the Holy Spirit testifies in every city, saying that chains and tribulations await me." So he was given some prophetic information about things that would happen in his life. He was given this information not that he would be worldly successful, but that he would go to Jerusalem. He knew that, and so he had to keep moving towards Jerusalem, even though many people would say, don't go there. Well, he knew he was supposed to go there, and because he was surrendered to God, he was okay with that. But what he did know was going to happen, that as he went to Jerusalem, that tribulations and chains awaited him. But see, somebody with a surrendered life is not concerned about those things. What they're concerned about is surrendering to what God has for them. This is why Paul kept going. And this is why then he says, none of these things move me. All these warnings you're giving me about don't do that and what's going to happen to me, I don't care about those things. Why did Paul not care about those things? Because his grid of how he measured success was different. How he measured success was that he would surrender to the plan that God had in his life. It didn't matter what that would be, because the results didn't matter. What mattered was his surrendering to that process that God had for him. So he said, I don't worry about those things. And he said, I don't count my life dear to me. Here's a different grid of success, isn't it? Paul is saying that what matters to me is that I finish my race with joy. Here's Paul's grid of success then. Here's Paul surrendering to God. He said, what matters to me is that I finish the race. I finish the plan. I finish the calling that God has for me. That's success to Paul. That's different. It's a whole different grid. And be sure, just as God will test us with patience, He'll test us with our surrender to Him. Are we really surrendered to Him? If the chips don't fall the way we think they should fall, will we continue to fulfill the calling that God has for us? Will we continue to move forward with joy? See, Paul said, for me, success is that I finish what God has for me. What success is that when things don't work out the way I want them to, and I start to struggle, that I don't quit, that I don't dive into worldliness, that I don't try to satisfy and appease myself in some other way. Paul says success for me is that I'm surrendered to God, whatever may happen, and that I keep moving forward in the plan and in the calling that God has for me. That's a different grid of success. He also wrote in 1 Corinthians 9, chapter 24, He said, do you not know that those who run in a race, they all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. You see what Paul's mentality is? It had nothing to do with what the world would tell him. It had everything to do with this race, this plan, this ideal, this course that God had for his life and his ability to stay to it. And that's why in 2 Timothy chapter 2, at the end of his life, right before he was about to die, he said, I have fought the good fight and I have what? Finish the race. Do you see that? I have kept the faith. That was his parting shot all through his life. His surrender to God was to such an extent that nothing that would come to block him from completing the race, or should I say anything that would come into his life that would try to trip him up, to hinder him, to block him, none of that stuff would matter because he saw his grid of success as the grid of surrendering to God and finishing what God had set him out to do. Fourth thing is found in verse 13. Success is measured by faithfulness. Faithfulness. Verse 13 of chapter 5 then, as the story moves on, after some days, King Agrippa, so this is a new person that's introduced to us here. King Agrippa, he was a king over this area. And he was a descendant of the Herods, the many different Herods that we've seen in the scriptures. And this king now, as he's moving through this province, this governor's province, it'd be customary as the king would move through the province to meet and greet that person that was over the province. So after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice, that was his sister, they came to Caesarea to greet Festus. Festus, the governor over the area. So now we have kings, we have governors, we have high priests, chief priests. We have a lot of big, important people here. When they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix. No doubt he was saying, thanks a lot, Felix. You could have just taken care of this guy before me. And about whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem asking for a judgment against him. And he says, to them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face and has an opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charges against him. Therefore, when they had come together without any delay, the next day I sat in the judgment seat, and he commanded the man to be brought in. When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusations against him of such things as I supposed. So he's explaining to Agrippa. Agrippa would be a guy who would be knowledgeable about Jewish things. The whole Herods in the scriptures, they'd be sort of interested. They were half Jewish themselves, and they were knowledgeable about Jewish things. And so the governor, Festus, he's saying, what do I do? Can you help me in this situation? Give me some advice. And so in verse 19, it said, he had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus. That's really the issue at hand. All the other accusations were just smokescreen. The real issue was about Jesus. It said, who had died, whom Paul affirms to still be alive. That's the whole issue right there. In verse 20, it says, and because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, that's the Nero. He said, "I commanded him to be kept till he could be till I could send him to Caesar, Caesar Augustus." And then Agrippa said to Festus, "I also would like to hear the man myself." Tomorrow, he said, "You shall hear him." Isn't this amazing? Do you see what's happening? The opportunities that Paul is having here. Now this guy, King Agrippa, sort of wants to get Agrippa on the situation, if you will. And he wants Paul to be brought out so Paul can talk to him as well. Isn't this amazing? The surrendered life to God and what it brings about, the opportunities. That had Paul listened to the counsel against him going to Jerusalem, listened to the counsel or been afraid of following and surrendering to God, and maybe have thought in his own wisdom, if I go there, I'm going to be bound and I'm not going to be effective in my ministry. If he would have listened to all those things, he would never have these opportunities to be before the biggest people in the world. Isn't that amazing? But we need to see this for what it's worth, need to understand that our role and responsibility is just that we're honoring God, that we're faithful, surrendering to Him, that we're patient. But see, all the things that happen outside of us, those are all God's things. Those are not our responsibilities to make ministry, to make our lives, to make careers and make jobs. Our responsibility is to be faithful. And that's what we see here with Paul. All these things are working themselves out to where Paul is demonstrating what he wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Says, "Let a man consider us as servants of Christ and as stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful." That's it. The grid of success that God looks at, how God measures success, is simply by our faithfulness to Him. Just faithfulness. And He's not going to look at the roll call in heaven and say, "Well, look how many people this person led to the Lord." Or, "Look how many people this person led to the Lord." Do you know we're not going to give account for those sort of things by numbers, by popularity, by how distinguished we are? We're not. And a lot of times we look at the life of Paul and we say, "Oh, that's how we should be. And if we're faithful, then our life will be like Paul's." And maybe in a way that's true. But do you know how many other people there are in the Bible that are faithful also, that their lives are not like this? We have John and we have all the different disciples and we have many people we can look at that their life is different. So we shouldn't look to copy the results of Paul. We should look to copy the heart of Paul. And in this particular point, it's just to be faithful. Hey, what opportunities has God put in your path today? In this season of life, it may not be exactly where you want to be, but what opportunities has He put in your way, and how faithful are you being to those responsibilities? That's what's important. What's required of me? What's required of you? That I read my Bible 3 hours a day, that I witness to 5 people a day, that I on and on. That's not what's required of me. What's required is simply this, that I'm faithful. That those open doors that God has for me, how faithful am I being to those things? That's it. That takes all the pressure off, you see. A lot of times we look in scriptures and we try to mimic the results. But we're told in the book of John, chapter 14 and 15, that the results are simply a byproduct of something. And we shouldn't look to copy results, but results are a byproduct of what? Abide in me and I in you. So everything that springs forth from our life, it springs forth from our relationship with God and our faithfulness to the very things that He has set before us today. So how successful are we today? Hey, we could be very successful by worldly standards, but how has God seen our faithfulness to Him? That's what He measures success by. The next point, and the last point, success is measured by obedience. Look in verse 23. So the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp. I like that. You just kind of picture that, don't you? Just the pomp. They're just coming with such heads up, pride, chest probably pointed out. What they would wear would say to the world that they're powerful. They'd have their purple robes on and people would bow down, maybe kiss their ring on their finger and just basically worshiping them. And that's how they came in. A lot of pomp. I like that word. And they entered the auditorium with the commanders. So now you have the commanders, the soldiers coming in. And the prominent men of the city. At Festus' command, then Paul was brought in. Amazing scene, isn't it? This is such the contrast between the way God sees things and the world sees things. Who's the hero here? Who's the successful person? Verse 24, Festus said, King Agrippa and all the men who are present here with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. Isn't that interesting? That by their standards, that Paul wasn't even a person that was fit to live on the same earth as them. But in verse 25, when I found that he had committed nothing deserving death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. And I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I might have something to write. Because if we're sending him to Caesar, we got to have something to write to say why he's coming here. And basically Festus is saying, I have nothing to write about him. For in verse 27, for it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not specify the charges against him. Isn't that interesting? And that's how worldly success is. It's unreasonable to think that one day we will stand before God and to think that some of the things that we are willing to sacrifice, godly things, spiritual things, in order to gain some sort of temporary worldly success that is so empty and so fleeting seems absurd, ridiculous. But you know, even as Christians, I'm not sure that we really, up until today, understand what the grid of success is and how God measures success. I'm not sure in churches, Christian churches today, that Christian churches understand and know what God is looking for and how He's measuring success in the church. It's important for us to know and understand the last point here is that no matter what was going to happen, Paul was going to be obedient to what God had for him. And Paul understood that because he had given his life and surrender to God, his life really wasn't about himself. It was about being obedient to God. And that was the point to him. And so this morning, hopefully we've now have a different grid of what it means to be successful. A different way to measure success. A different way to come before God in our prayer closet and know that the Lord is pleased with us. In a way where we can rest our head on our pillows at night knowing that we have the smile of God and that He is well pleased. And I hope and pray this morning that our grid will change and that our energies and our focus and our priorities and the things that we will gauge success by will change. And so that we'll see that God sees the heart. He sees and recognizes patience, a good conscience before God and men, a surrendered life to Him, faithfulness, and obedience. And really what it comes down to is that success is what God thinks of us. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that we can be successful people in Your eyes, God. Father, I pray that You'd help us to be less concerned about what the world may think of us and more concerned about what You think of us, Lord. And Father, I pray that You'd shift our thinking so that we would think correctly and understand, God, how You measure success. And Lord, help us to be satisfied, fulfilled, and content, knowing, Lord, that we are well-pleasing to You. And Father, let the things of the world come and go as they may. Let worldly success come and go as You see fit. But let our aim and our heart be